Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper in 2019, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen. We have made it into the new year and we are ready to rock and roll when it comes to movies. But I am not doing any rocking and rolling all by myself. I have, of course, my trusty compatriots in this race to watch movies.
Who are we racing?
With me is Mr. Chad Riley.
Hi.
How's it going?
Happy New Year, everybody.
There you go.
We know you missed us last week.
And with us as well is Mr. Spencer Williams.
I'm still wondering who we're racing exactly.
We're racing against everybody, Spencer.
All right.
Everybody.
Fun fact, I actually saw the guy who voices Mario this weekend.
Woohoo! Random factoids. We got a great show for you tonight, as we're going to be talking about 2018. Now, this past year has been so great, and we're so excited to talk about movies, and so we're going to be talking about some of our favorites from this past year and see where that goes.
And some of our not-so-favorites.
So before we do, Chad, why don't you give us a little bit of those 2019 opening credits?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I felt like it's a new year, new me, new us. Let's just go ahead and do away, at least for one episode, with the scripted bit. So I'll just quickly tell you, we're presented by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios, and you can find us on all your streaming platforms of choice. Those include Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom.
Yeah, yeah.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Concise. No, but our URLs. People can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101.
That's right. Also, too, to let you know, you can catch all of our episodes on our website at filmlosophers.com. We are looking at about 144, if you include this one, episodes in the bucket. And we are, like, so excited because of the fact that that is over 2 years worth of content and then some. And we're still
almost
going strong.
At our third anniversary. Our
exactly.
Third birthday.
Three.
Yep. Pretty big.
Yep. And speaking about birthdays and anniversaries, I also wanted to mention one little small thing about this podcast. And this is actually the anniversary of Mr. Spencer Williams joining us.
Let's not have two separate anniversaries.
We have to mention the fact that Spencer has been with us for already a full year. He is off probation. He can start getting a paycheck. this is just a great opportunity to celebrate Mr. Williams and show him that, you know what, he is a great asset to this team, and we enjoy his many, many screams and yells in every episode.
Well, I mean, if people would just make better movies, I wouldn't be screaming as much.
And speaking of better movies, great segue as we talk about 2018 in review. Obviously, this past year has been a very interesting year for movies and for filmmakers. You have everything from big action pieces to big social commentary pieces, everything that has been moving people either emotionally and, you know, spiritually. Films this year have been doing such a great job from not just live action, but even all the way to animation. And it's great to see that we got a chance to experience a lot of that in this past year on this podcast. I'm just excited because of the fact that we're going to get a chance to just really look back and see what really worked and what didn't. And I'm looking already at Spencer, and I'm loving the face because he knows I'm going to be bringing up some stuff that he just doesn't want to hear. And it's great seeing his face crinkle already.
I have no idea what you're even talking about.
Well, you'll see. But yeah, I mean, it's really awesome. I don't know. What do you think? What did you think, Chad, of this past year in terms of movies?
You know, this year, there were some movies that I really, 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 really liked and enjoyed. Some of them I knew I was going to like. Hello, Infinity War. Heart eye emoji.
Heart eye emoji.
Sad eye emoji. And others that surprised me. And then there were some that I really, 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 really despised.
Oh, wow.
And Blake Lively, I'm looking at you. Anna Kendrick, I'm looking at you. Well, why?
We'll dig into them in a little
bit. So it'll be fun.
Bit.
It'll be fun to review.
What about you, Spencer? How did you feel 2018 compared to other years in terms of films?
Okay, see, I'm a bad person to ask that question to.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask that question
to. No, because, like, 2018 is the year I saw the most movies of my life. So, like, normally I kind of just, like, see, like, you know, oh, I have to see this in a theater type movies, not the ones where I'm mildly interested. Those usually get saved for Redbox and rentals.
True.
So this was really different, getting to see everything just in the theater. And it's a wild experience, like, sitting through a bad movie, because normally you can just turn it off, but you can't that time. But that's fine. Like, it was an interesting year. I'll definitely say that.
I think interesting is a good way to put it, because I was thinking about it before we went on the air. I was thinking, I'm like, what's a great way to encapsulate what 2018 was in terms of cinema? And I think interesting is the better word. I was trying to think if it was a great year or a good year or the best year or a bad year or however. And I think interesting is the best term to use, because you think about everything that has debuted. I think you honestly have to say 2018 was probably the biggest year for film adaptations, because this year, I don't know if I've ever seen in any year as many film adaptations from either comics, books, whatever it may be, than this year alone.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have. I mean, every year you kind of go through that, I guess you'd say, that tension of, like, do you repackage stuff? Like, do you remake movies that have been made before? Do you keep making sequels? Do you keep doing franchise, you know, big marquee pieces? Or do you really, you know, go off the beaten path and chart your own course and try to do something, like, in the independent vein and get it off the ground? And by and large, most of the films, at least the ones that we reviewed, there were a few that we didn't get to, obviously, yeah. But there are a few that we didn't get to that are still franchise or sequel, mm-hmm. or, you know, adapted from a book or whatever. But most of the movies that we reviewed are exactly what everybody says they don't like, right? Yeah. Like, this is Hollywood being uncreative. And I would say, yeah, that's true to a certain extent, but then when you have something that's successful and that people want to see more of, Avengers Infinity War, mm-hmm. You should keep it going until it loses steam. So I don't know that that's altogether a bad thing.
Yeah. And that's one thing. Chad actually touched on something that we really want to emphasize. We are going to be pulling from, in terms of the conversation we have, we're going to be pulling from films that we've reviewed on this show. So we'll be able to give you the reference lesson to go back to if you want to hear more about that.
Pull out your notepads and your pencils, because we're going to give you some numbers.
Exactly. We're not going
and they're
to.
They're not our phone numbers.
We're not going to. No one's trying to get in trouble here. We're not going to pull from films we haven't seen. We're only going to give you the information from stuff we do know. So don't worry. We have credentials to back up what we say when we say it tonight. So I'd like to go ahead and kind of kick this off. And I think I want to kick it off on going from the bad to the good. And I want to say one of the films that I was actually disappointed in, and not so much as I expected it to be bad, but I actually expected it to be good, and it turned out bad, was A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
A Wrinkle in Time, starring Oprah Winfrey and, let's see, you got... it was an Ava...
Reese Witherspoon.
Mindy Kaling. A film by Ava DuVernay. The film starred, obviously, like you said, Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, Mindy Kaling, Chris Pine, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, as well as some new...
Coolest name ever.
Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
I love her name.
I actually got it right. I think I remember in the episode that I actually struggled with that. By the way, that is lesson 104, A Wrinkle in Time. For me, the film seemed over-stylized, and there was just way too much focus on the graphics and the immersion of what they could do. The story just kind of seemed all over the place. And as much as I was hoping, because I remember the book, I remember reading the book when I was younger, I remember it being a part of my childhood, not like the highlight of my childhood, but a part of it. So by this time, and I believe the film did debut around May, or March, I'm sorry, around March, this was at the tail end of award season. So and this is no disrespect to any filmmaker out there, but this is usually when serious movies start dropping in terms of into the theaters. If you're unaware, January, February, and early March tend to be awards season. So when a film drops, usually January, February, early March, it's usually because they're wanting to either hold on to a franchise or a property due to, you know, rights and whatnot. And so either way, the film dropped in early March, and I was thinking, all right, you can't really go wrong. Ava DuVernay had already had massive success with The 13th.
Selma.
And Selma. You know, all these other films prior to film, documentary. And so there was high hopes. A Wrinkle in Time was one of those types of books that just really engages you, and it's really interesting. And so you're hoping, from the perspective of somebody like Ava DuVernay, you're wanting to see something grand. You're wanting to see a really profound statement being made. And it kind of fell flat for me. Like, I didn't get that out of this film. Yes, I got spurts and bouts of, like, positive encouragement and women empowerment through posters and through the misspeakings of Mindy Kaling and whatnot. But I think overall...
She was speaking poetry.
She was speaking other people's words is what she was
yeah.
doing. But I don't know. Like,
I thought it was a grand artistic touch.
Oh, well.
It's not true.
No, not true. That's,
I mean, couldn't she just really say anything because other people say pretty much anything?
Didn't she actually give a Kanye West quote at some point?
At one point, yeah.
She did.
Yeah. No. but, I mean, for me, the film, I was hoping. I really wanted that film to work, and I really wanted to see, like, Ava DuVernay had already done, like we said, success with Selma, and then the massive amounts of people who were on board with the Netflix documentary, The 13th. It just seemed like this was going to be one of those films where she starts stepping into the mainstream element of, like, getting more of her message and so forth into, you know, films that belong to the big House of Mouse. And unfortunately, I don't think she had enough push or was given enough ability to sell her message entirely. I don't know.
You know, it was one of those films, and we run into this time and time and time again. One of the things that really stands out about the book in my memory, which admittedly I was in fifth grade when I had to read this for English class, so it's been a while. But I remember the book being more relatable than the movie felt. And I know that it's the movie is made for kids. The book was written for kids. But the movie, I think, relied so heavily on the special effects.
Yeah.
I almost wish, and not a knock against Ava DuVernay, but
no, not at
I
all.
Almost wish they had given her a smaller budget so that she really leaned more into the relatable aspects of the story and less into the fantastical. I understand it's a fantasy. It's a science fiction fantasy book, and it needs to have certain things like a character that can change shape and, you know, they go to different worlds and whatever. I get all that. It was kind of creepy. I didn't really... It was aesthetically unappealing in many ways. Like the way that Reese Witherspoon's character would, like, turn inside out kind of to transform. And then, like, some of the worlds were just, like, it was a little extra.
Yeah.
I think visually there was a lot of visual noise that you missed really the heart of certain scenes within the story. I think overall you don't lose the heart of the story because there's, you know, searching for their father and finding strength within and getting the reunion and all that kind of stuff. But I think that pieces along the way that were meant in the original book, the scenes along the way were meant to mean something.
Yeah.
And they're kind of almost like these trite stepping stones that lose some of their punch because so much has been devoted to the look of it, of the fantasticalness. And so you get like an Aesop's fable, like here's the moral of the fable for this scene. Now let's move on. And you really things don't simmer as long as they could. They don't have as much power as they could. And I think that's because they leaned a little too far into the wizardry of it, of the special effects, visual effects.
And I think that's one of the things that really takes away from the film because of the fact that, yes, you can have, and I think I remember stating this in the actual episode in Lesson 104, you can have a film that's directly adapted from a novel or from a source and go word for word, panel for panel, page for page, and that's fine. I mean, if that's your goal, if that's what you're driving to do, by all means, you go for it. But when it comes to filmmakers who naturally out of the, when they're out of the industry, when they're not creating content or whatnot, they have a message and they're speaking that message and they're really pushing forward with the message that they have, you expect to see that message also bleed into their work. You expect them to do that kind of preaching, if you will. And I use the term loosely, but preaching in their projects, in their pieces. You look at Spike Lee. Spike Lee is one of the most evangelistic cinematic filmmakers I know. And in every single one of his films, he says something that has to pertain to his overall message. And it gets spoken and you hear it. And the moment you hear it, you're like, yep, this is a Spike Lee movie. And so I think I was expecting Ava DuVernay to have that same sense of, this is my movie and I'm going to create it in the way that I feel it needs to be heard by young people today. Not even for adults, but for young people. And I think that kind of gets lost within, as Chad so mentioned, all the digital noise, all the, you know, visuals and everything that's going on in the film that you're so focused on that you're missing out on great opportunities to really shine for the story.
And so, like, the kernels of those things are still there.
Oh, yeah.
They just don't really get to blossom all the way.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of like rushing through a bunch of big set pieces and big costumes.
Yeah. So that was one of the lower points for me from 2018. What about you, Spence? Do you have any higher low points?
I'm going to go with you and talk about a low point.
Oy,
I'm
going to
go with Pacific Rim
Uprising. Oh, my gosh.
I wasn't even expecting this movie to be good. Like, I was expecting to be bored because the trailers did not impress me. And
for just, anybody wondering, that is Lesson 107, mm-hmm. Pacific Rim Uprising.
Yeah, so during that movie just turned into a mess of just nonsense and logical jumps that were really hard to understand why anybody would make any of the choices that they made in that movie, like in the movie and behind the scenes of the movie, really.
Yeah.
Because I just realized people made this movie and they thought that was a good idea.
Like, somebody higher up actually said yes to this.
Idea. And so, like, it was just, and I will never forget the end of this movie where they just had like a snowball fight at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Be
it's
victorious.
Funny. You said, I'll never forget the end of this movie. And I'm like, I completely forgot the end of this movie. I forgot most of this movie, I'll be honest.
I thought he was talking about the Charlie Day, John Boyega scene.
Oh, my gosh.
That
Charlie
was even
Day in this movie. Everything they did with Charlie Day's character in this movie was the wrong decision.
Yes.
That was probably the creepiest character from this past year that I
Yeah,
wish,
super creepy.
Yeah, having some type of a relationship with a kaiju brain in his own apartment building. It was really weird.
I can't even go back to the episode if you want me to get into what was wrong with that entire sequence. But, yeah, it was just nonsense. And it was just really disappointing that, like, because the first one was decent and really good. And this movie is none of those things.
Yeah.
It's like just the shambling corpse of the first movie.
Well, and one of the bigger things, so I mentioned this in Lesson 107, one of the things for me that really had me sold onto hoping this was going to be somewhat decent was that the first one was directed by Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Spirit Animal, got it.
Yes. So the fact that he was still a producer on for this film, yet he wasn't directing, it did kind of give me some fear, but I still hoped as well, and yeah, my dreams were crushed.
Now we all know producers mean nothing.
Producers make bank. Yeah, I think that this was another one of those where they Number one, they got a lot of great like cross promotion commercial ad time from Windows Surface Pro, all leading up to this movie, and it's like, oh, cool! They like did you know cool stuff on tablets and everything, and then you look at it and you're like, oh,
oh my gosh!
But they worked from a garbage script that was awful. But yeah, there were very few things that I found enjoyable about that this you know follow up film because it was like. You weren't entirely sure why it got made by the time it was done. You know, it's like even the excuse of, well, the first one made enough money to warrant a sequel.
I wish that
okay.
wasn't an excuse.
People like giant fighting robots. Okay. But then this is what you gave us? Like, this is not a worthy second step. It's you know, it's like when somebody, some new musical artist or group has a really great debut album and then the sophomore album is terrible and doesn't even hit the same notes as the first one did. It just that's exactly what this movie felt like for me.
You know what this movie felt like for me?
This, a waste of time.
Well, that too. This felt like the modern day this modern day version of Grease 2. Everybody in Grease 2 was a cousin or related to somebody, and nobody from the first film was actually in it except for those people who were really hurting for money.
Yeah.
And that's what you got. You got some kind of hodgepodge mess of a film that didn't even closely resemble its predecessor. And if you haven't seen Grease 2, by all means, go see that grease fire of a film, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. A young Michelle Pfeiffer who is apparently related to Danny Zuko, and yeah, I'm not even lying.
I haven't seen Grease 2.
Neither have I. I've seen the poster a number of times. Can we talk about mine?
Yes, I was going to say
that. I know this is going to shock. Shock and appall. Lesson 132. A Simple Favor.
Oh, my
which
Lord.
Which we subtitled,
Jesus.
Please Don't Watch This Movie. That's what we called the episode.
We were not subtle at all.
Now, we didn't say don't listen to our review of the movie, so if you haven't done so, you should go and do so. Because actually, it's kind of fun. When we don't like a movie, we have a lot of fun.
Oh, no doubt.
Poking at it and complaining a lot. Yeah, I'm not going to go on and on because I've mentioned this a number of times. In other episodes randomly, but I don't know what it was that I liked the least about this movie. There was basically every element I didn't like. Like there was almost like I would have rather sat in a dark theater with like Yanni playing over the speakers and a blank screen,
like
so at
Yanni.
Least I could fall asleep.
Oh,
than
okay,
have
I
watched this movie.
I get you now. Okay, yeah, this
I
movie.
Understand.
I mean, like even there were some kid characters. Kids are cute. People like kids,
yeah.
Right? There were some kid characters that were kind of cute, but then they weren't. Like one of them got violent and like. Was just a brat, and it was just there was 0% of the movie that I even remotely enjoyed.
One of the things about movies that I like to do, especially like I mentioned earlier in the episode, because we've had so many film adaptations, one of the things that I try to do is I try to read the source material from which most of these films come from. If I can't read through it all, I'll read through part of it, or I'll at least get the gist of it. I bought the book that this film was based on.
Why?
Well, here's the thing. I used an Audible.
Why?
I used an Audible credit.
Why?
Don't worry. It
translates into money, though.
After we did our episode, I returned the book. I have never
yes.
returned a book. I never knew that process for Audible until that day. And I'm like, I don't even want to see how this fares to the source material. I don't care. This movie was garbage. This movie made me just hate crime thrillers for a season. I'm like, I don't even want to watch another. Like, I'd rather go and read an Encyclopedia Brown book than watch another movie like this. Because this movie was just complete and utter garbage. What did you think, Spence? mouth drop and everything.
Yeah, I remember being mildly interested in this movie, and then while we were watching it, I was mildly interested in leaving. Until I was heavily interested in leaving. It was just a mess going from like, oh, my friend's missing, into, oh, no, I'm sleeping with her husband for some reason. And then just all over
the place.
And then
she's back.
Yeah, she's not
creepily
dead because she had a twin. That's
gosh, she put all her clothes back in her own closet.
That's creepy.
That was probably the part that annoyed me the most, is that she ended up having a twin at the end of this movie. It's like, do you know how many times someone has done something to, oh, there was a secret twin all along? Like, that's just such a cop-out.
Yeah.
I think cop-out's the probably theme that ran through some of these films this past year. Because, honestly, I think another film in terms of my choice for just really was not enjoyable was Sicario, Day of the Soldado. The first film, although gritty and similar in terms of its raw reality, still had a story. And it still had a story that I was interested in. And it wasn't so much just focused on how much it could do to shock you. It was more focused on driving the story, and the gore and the reality of it was a facet of that story.
Yeah.
Sicario 2 is what most people in the cinematic world would call gore porn, because all it does is focus on how much it can get away with without having to get an NC-17 rating. And in all honesty,
in terms of violence,
I need to clarify.
There wasn't a whole lot of other.
No.
Yeah.
But in terms of violence, this film really just seemed to thrive in its ability to, or it seemed to like thriving in its ability to shock and awe you with each scene that it had from the get-go, which, mind you, Sicario Part 1 had that as well at the get-go, but then a story developed and you were following characters and you had a character that you were rooting for and you were watching. There was nobody to root for in this movie.
No, there wasn't.
And I didn't want to see anybody still alive at the end of this movie.
I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, he showed up. He and his wife showed up right around the middle of the movie. His name was Angel.
What?
And they ended up at the family's house out in the desert.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was like the one bright spot. I talk about it in the episode too, but it was
lesson
the one
119,
bright,
by the way.
Oh, yeah. It was the one bright spot of the movie. I still remember
that's
it
right.
because it was such a counterpoint to the entire rest of the movie.
That's right.
It's the only element that I want to hold on to after leaving the theater. Like, the rest of it, I'd like to forget because it was very disturbing.
It was.
Not that after seeing the first one, it wasn't surprising that that was going to happen. But still, the first one, Sicario, Denis Villeneuve.
Yes.
And I can't remember the composer's name. But they did just such a and the cinematographer, all of them, masterful job of telling a very disturbing story in a way that still made you care. This one just kind of bludgeons you over the head from start to finish.
Literal and metaphorically.
And the only bright spot to me was that character, Angel, and his wife. Because he was deaf.
He was deaf.
She was I think they were all deaf. But Benicio del Toro's character spoke sign language.
That's
so
right.
So he was able to communicate with them. And they were very poor, but they helped however they could, and you didn't, like, the only thing, I would have been so angry with this movie if they showed the people that were chasing Benicio del Toro and the girl, like, rolling up to Angel's house and killing that whole family because they had some contact. I was so worried, because the movie was so dark, I was worried that they were going to go ahead and do that just to, like, not leave any open-ended pieces of any kind. And I'm like, please do not. My psyche cannot handle that much darkness. Thankfully, they didn't.
By the way, from the first film, from Sicario, Johan Johansson, which sadly
he
passed away.
Yeah.
But it's no surprise after his work with Denis Villeneuve on Arrival in terms of musical scores.
I still salivate over that movie. It's so good.
No joke. That movie, I listened to that soundtrack anytime I need to just kind of zone out at work or mm-hmm. even in the bedroom, like I just put that on and I'll just sleep. But it's sad to say that, you know what, this film could have been a little bit more. It could have been much more of a story element. There could have been more to it. Expounding a bit more on like the dynamic between Josh Brolin and, you know, Benicio del Toro's character, actually creating story. It just seemed like a lot of like that bro kind of thing, that relationship from afar, like, oh, well, if you got to do what you got to do, yeah, I'll do what I do and you do what you do. All right. What does that mean? Like, what? But that's...
Yeah, it was just... It was sort of like, I don't know... Again, the movie influenced my thinking, but it's sort of like, you know, in those, like, torture movies where somebody has, like, a screw to the side of your head and just slowly is turning it and drawing blood and whatever. That's what that movie was like for me. It was, like, just this slow... turning large screw to the head that's like, I would really rather leave.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Spence? Any other films that you think didn't hit the mark this year?
Are we only talking about movies we've reviewed or just movies we've seen?
Let's focus more on movies that we've seen and reviewed here on the episode just so we can reference back.
Okay. I'm going to switch over to a good one.
Oh.
Because...
Wait, I have another bad one.
Okay.
Can we finish the bad ones before we switch to good ones?
Let's do bad some more.
Because this actually parallels, Spencer, your choice, Pacific Rim 2, where you have a producer that you feel like you can trust. Eddie, who was it? This is what happened. I knew I'd catch him because he wasn't paying attention. Guillermo del Toro.
Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah. I thought you liked the guy.
Oh, my gosh.
Lesson 141, Mortal Engines.
Oh, my gosh.
No.
You think that you can trust it because it's the dude who did Lord of the Rings.
Mr. Peter Jackson himself.
And it's a passion project of his. He's been working on it for over a decade. His writing team, his effects shop, all of it. He didn't direct it. But, like, all of his people.
Mm-hmm.
Were the behind the scenes of this thing. It had a massive budget, mostly completely unknown cast, and a whole bunch of story elements. Like, I won't even do it the dignity and the justice of saying it was borrowed from other elements. It was stolen. There were there were massive story elements that were stolen from every other popular story that you know and like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and like et cetera, et cetera. And the hodgepodge cobbled together steampunk mess that resulted was just inexcusable. I think that was the word I used in the review. Because it's like literally like 8 minutes in, you're sitting there thinking, how dare you?
How dare you? And it's sad. I was trying to look up the director for that particular film, which it's weird to think. I don't know why Peter Jackson would choose to, and I don't know if this was his decision or not, but I know he has weight in that, to choose to give such a large budgeted film to somebody who had never directed anything prior to. Like, this was his directorial debut for a feature film, and because he had done smaller short films prior. But to give something like this to where there were many, many, many people who were fans of the books prior, who knew of the source material, and were hoping to see something that reminisced that story, and it totally falling flat completely as we watched it in IMAX. Like, not even seeing it in IMAX saved it.
Nope.
So... I really just kind of have to question the judgment on that end.
I will say, though, it validated a lot in me about my reaction to teaser trailers, because I remember seeing the tease for this. I really want to say they first teased it during the Super Bowl. I really think that the first tease was sometime during the Super Bowl broadcast. I might be wrong about that, but it was on TV that I saw it, and I remember thinking, wait, what? Like, that doesn't look good. Like, it doesn't cities that drive around like cars and eat other cities. There's something very dumb about that idea.
Yeah.
And like to see it brought to life. It is every bit as stupid as I thought it would be.
Yeah.
No offense to people who like the books, because I think when you're reading a book and you're building the world in your mind,
yeah,
there's a certain like je ne sais quoi kind of magic of engaging your creative side and your imagination and co-building the world with the writer. Mm. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
When it's fed to you on a movie screen and like loud, bombastic jump cuts and way too close up camera angles and just bad physics and like stolen story plot lines from other things and just a mess. It was a hot mess. That's where I'm like, this is stupid. Why?
Yeah.
Why was $100 million plus wasted on this? There are better ideas that are going to resonate better with audiences out there, and yet here goes $100 million down the tube, down the toilet. You know, but not so much the book side of things,
no.
Because there's a lot of stuff that happens in books. It's like, that's a really dumb idea, but it was executed well.
Yeah.
And it engaged my imagination, and I grew or changed or whatever through the process of reading and experiencing, you know, it in that medium. I think when you put it on the big screen, even in IMAX, and it's, you know, just a pile of you know what, you know, then it's like, okay, there's no excuse though for that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not enough we can say in this episode that will ever be able to be enough. That's why we have a whole episode for it. So if you haven't checked that out, you said there was less than 140.
141.
141.
Darn you and the city you rode in on.
Yeah, I like that title.
That's another one of my favorite subtitles.
One of the ones that I kind of wanted to highlight, because I know you're going to want to go into good, Spencer, so I just want to give one more bad. Another bad film that I felt really missed the mark so bad. It missed it so far that it totally ruined any other side projects from that studio for this particular franchise. And I'm talking about Lesson 115, Solo.
Oh, yeah.
That movie was booty.
We did not give it a bad review.
We gave it
a middling review.
But in comparison to the whole of what it did. So it's here's the thing.
I agree with you, though. It's lamentable that it has totally killed the anthology films
exactly.
For the time being.
Because it's one thing to have the episode, and you can go back to Lesson 115, and you can hear us talking about it, but then the weeks that followed and the aftermath that ensued because of this film and how poorly it performed in the box offices, and then it causing this chain reaction within Disney and within Lucasfilms to suddenly say, you know, we're not going to do any more anthology films until we can get this mechanism right. It's like, no, wait. No, don't do that, because this was a stupid idea from the get-go. Just don't even touch it. Go back to doing the Obi-Wan stuff and all that other stuff. But because of how poorly this film did, it completely derailed all of what they had planned for the foreseeable future from that franchise.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, because like Rogue One, which, you know, was the non-numbered Star Wars before that was actually really good.
So good.
And like, I was not even expecting it. I was expecting it to be more like Solo before Solo came out, and it was actually rather fantastic. So it does make me rather sad that they're not going to go on with their original plan, because, you know, one bump on the road isn't, you know, enough to really throw over your entire
cart.
It
was so knee-jerk of them to do, because it didn't get the reception that you wanted it to get.
Yeah. Plain and simple.
That totally valid, but like, to then derail your other projects because of it.
Yeah.
That was an interesting decision.
Yeah. Well, and it just shows kind of where the sensitivity of the higher ups are with this franchise at this point. You know, when it came to Solo, so just speaking about Solo, because there's all the other drama that's going on with the other films prior, with, you know, the reception of Episode 7 and then the poor reception that a lot of people are had with Episode 8 and all that. Just with Solo alone, there was so much drama going on behind the scenes, ultimately leading to directors Phil Lord and Christopher Miller removing themselves from the project altogether, almost more than halfway through filming the movie. Bringing in Ron Howard was one of those kind of like, all right, we need to get a star player. We need to bring him in. Ron Howard is a very interesting choice for me to direct a Star Wars film. It's not that he can't do it, but I don't know how well he does in sci-fi.
Well, and here's the thing. I feel bad for Ron Howard.
Oh, completely.
He inherited a pile of steaming turd sandwiches behind the scenes and then had to put on a smiley face mm-hmm. and say, yep, everything's great. We're reshooting X percent of the film. We're going to tell you it's only X percent because everybody's making a big deal about it already. And
yeah.
Like, I don't really super fault him. I think there was a lot behind the scenes. Yeah. Before he was ever involved, he got a broken toy mm-hmm. and was told, hey, go show this to all the kids and make them like it.
Yeah.
And there was only so much he could do to fix it.
I
do think that having seen what at least one half of that dynamic duo went on to do later on this year or last year with Into the Spider-Verse, I think it's pretty clear however the breakdown happened,
mm-hmm.
I would much rather have seen their version of the film.
Like, yeah.
I don't care if it was like, well, they're doing too much impromptu on the set. They're straying from the script. Okay, they can make witty, fun, lighthearted, adventurous stuff. Lego movie, don't knock it. It's really great. I liked it a lot, even on rewatching it. You know, so it's mm-hmm. like, I really... We had our druthers, as we say in the Midwest, and probably the South too, probably anywhere. If we had our druthers, I'd rather have seen their version of the movie.
I agree completely. And it's to Chad's point, yes, it's not to Ron Howard's fault. Ron Howard was given this project already in shambles. It's, you know,
it was almost finished.
It was almost
principal
finished.
Photography was like 2 weeks out,
and he had to reshoot
from being done.
He had to reshoot 80% of the, or he had to have had. Shot and directed 80% of the film in order for him to get director credits. And so, you know, Ron Howard is not going to put his name on someone else's project. I don't think he's that type of director. I think if he's going to do something, he's going to do it with his vision and his, you know, his stamp on it, which is, you know, completely within his rights. He's the man that's directing the ship. He can put his name on the boat. You know, I feel like this film seemed to not know what direction it was wanting to go in terms of like the feel and the humor side mm-hmm. and if it was trying to be more funny or if it was trying to be a little bit more, you know, serious. And then, like I said, the biggest kind of bomb that occurred within this film was not so much the film itself, but its aftermath. You know, it's kind of like the EMP blast after an atomic bomb, things like that. Like, you see its blowback and you see what it caused, and it's for that reason mostly. The film itself had its issues, but for me, mostly because of all the aftermath, that it for me is one of the worst films of 2018. But transitioning from worst, let's talk about good. Let's kind of get a little positivity going, and it looked like Spence has been itching to talk
about
that.
Stuff in here.
Let's start the positivity train.
There we go.
Like, one of the best movies I saw last year was Blindspotting.
Ah, you
love
took
that
it.
Movie. I
you
don't
took
care.
It.
I took it. We weren't even going to talk about that
what?
Movie until I saw it
what?
Randomly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, that's
you're
right.
Right. You're right. You're
yeah.
right.
So, Blindspotting, like, just took me by surprise because it was just such a well-thought-out movie.
Less than 126, by the way.
Yep. And, I never really saw like a movie where like freestyle rap was kind of used to vent someone's frustrations
mm-hmm.
and done in a way that really spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was really amazing, and I still super recommend it. It's one of my top movies from last year, really.
I agree. I think Blindspotting, so thanks a lot, Spence, because he took the one of the ones I was going to say. Blindspotting was by far one of the best films of 2018 for me. You have David Diggs and Rafael Cassell playing two natives of Oakland who are just going through the motions and trying to face life, you know, while the gentrification of all the Oakland you know, neighborhoods and suburbs are getting taken over, and so much is happening within the film, and you have to see it to really take it all in. But this film is like poetry in motion, and not just the action kind, but even the way they speak and the way their words enact. Like, their words have meaning, and their words have like a resulting action to them, and it's it's very powerful. Mm-hmm. I believe when we talked about it on the episode, I think Chad, you had mentioned in terms of like Shakespeare and how this film seemed very Shakespearean in its way of
It felt like a you know, like they do, whether it's a Fathom event or a local, well, not necessarily local, but a theater, a live stage production.
Yeah.
And you do these modernizations of or reinterpretations of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what this movie felt like to me.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a specific Shakespeare play that I would say it's patterned after, but in terms of the way that they just beautifully inventively use language in the film, and the way that, you know, the stakes are raised, and then like just everything about it felt like a modern day Shakespeare film to me. And not to say that it's derivative of a Shakespeare play, but just there is a certain elevated quality to a lot of Shakespeare's works. And it felt like, even though this was, you know, the mean streets of Oakland, there is an elevated quality to the way this story is told.
Yeah.
And it's rare that we see it in film. I think you see that kind of storytelling more in live productions.
Yeah.
In theater. To see it in film is really special. And to see it in a film like this that was also hyper relevant for like where our culture is at this time, in terms of how do we even know how to relate or get along with each other if we have different backgrounds. And you know, all of that, it's very, there's a timelessness, but there's also a timeliness to it. And it was this perfect collection of all the right elements and all the right choices. And I think that I wish I was hearing more about it. Now that we're in award season, I wish I was hearing more nominations for it. I wish that it was re-released into theaters so people could go see it if they didn't catch it the first time. Because it kind of like blipped on the radar and then it was gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, Spencer, you saw it 1 week and we saw it a week or two later and then it was out.
Gone.
Like, we had one option of a theater to go to, and then the next week it wasn't there either. So, and that's a shame, because it really, it's a gem of a movie. Really, really, absolutely. In terms of like the most surprising reaction from me, I'd say this one takes top marks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have to agree in terms of everything Chad said. This film really did take me by surprise, because in all honesty, we were uncertain about that particular week, and Spencer mentioned it saying, oh, I saw this film last week and it was really great. I think we should do it on the podcast. And so we're like, well, we didn't really have anything. It was between that and another film, and we chose this one. We're like, we'll just go see it. So we went to go see it at a late showing, and when we got out, I was just blown away. I think we actually had begun talking about the film immediately as soon as we got out of the theater in the middle of the parking lot.
Well, you kind of have to. It's that kind of movie.
Yeah. So I think this film definitely should be checked out. And if you haven't had a chance to, go and rent it, buy it, see it. I mean, honestly, if you buy it, you won't have any regrets at all. The film is completely surprising and incredible.
Yeah.
What about you, Chad? Any highlights from this past year in terms of positivity?
Positivity. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and drop a note. I'm not going to choose this one.
Huh?
Nobody's surprised that I really enjoyed Infinity War. We devoted 3 episodes in a row to it.
We did.
We did 110, 111, and something special in between. So, I mean, the proof is in the pudding there.
It's
there's
true.
No need to like wax philosophical about it. You'll get probably a very similar treatment as Endgame approaches
very
late
true.
April. Mm-hmm. What I did want to focus on was a style of movie that I typically don't go for that really impressed me in ways that were surprising, which was Lesson 133 in terms of our episode archive, Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh, yes. My goodness.
I don't go for period pieces usually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go for crime pieces usually. I don't go for cult, like, elements because mm-hmm. they're, you know, the cult is part of, you know, the storytelling mechanic and what some of the characters are connected to here. But I loved this movie. I thought it was...
Yeah.
So unique. I thought it was just incredible in terms of, what is it, Cynthia Erivo?
Yes.
Yes.
Good heavens, put this woman in every movie you can.
Mm-hmm.
I loved her in this movie. Mm-hmm. I want to see it again. I haven't yet seen it a second time.
By the way, I bought it, so just in case you want to see
well,
it.
Well, we know what we're doing this weekend.
There you go.
But I didn't know if I was going to like it because it had all the elements that I don't typically like. And I knew that going in. But then to see, even though it is every bit as dark and disturbing as you think it's going to be, still, like, I don't know what it was. It was really her. She was the full counterweight to all of the darkness in that movie. Like, she had 95% of the opposite side of the scales.
Oh,
to balance it out. And it was absolutely brilliant. I thought her performance was flawless. I love her voice. I know she comes from Broadway, you know, but like, put her in every movie, please.
Yeah.
I remember like just watching this movie and like halfway through, I was like, if she dies during this movie, I will lose my mind.
It is unforgivable. It would be unforgivable.
Because she was just the best part. She's the light of the movie and like, you can't take her out of it. She was just amazing in it.
I have to agree on all aspects for this film. Obviously, I love to joke about how John Hamm is the best thing in any film that goes in, that he's in, and blah blah blah. And mind you, it's a joke. I enjoy getting on Chad's nerves when it comes to John Hamm.
You enjoy getting on everyone's nerves.
Listen to some of the earlier episodes. That's a good point. I don't want to talk over that point. Let's sit there for a second. Listen to some of our earlier episodes. We used to do like special content features, one of which was Fantasy Cast. We had like a little Mariah Carey like music bed that played during
Fantasy
it, whatever.
Fantasy Cast.
Half the time, this man wants to cast John Hamm in every role, including the female roles.
He could play a good Abraham Lincoln. Just saying. So
what?
And apparently a good Eleanor Roosevelt. That's so... Eddie is bipartisan, like he's not judging. He will cast John Hamm in any role.
Equality for all.
I don't know that I'd go that far, but I would agree with you on him in this movie.
Well, and he's not even like the high point that I want to talk about, but mentioning him, he does play an opposite role as to what we're used to when it comes to him. He's not the womanizing, you know, fully empty-headed jughead, if you will. That's usually in most other films. He seems very focused. He's, you know, sly. He's very smart for the time that he's on screen. But I think the bigger highlight of this film for me had to be Chris Hemsworth. The fact that they could make somebody whom I've been rooting for the last 10 plus years in terms of movies from the Marvel Cinematic Universe as Thor, somebody who I've seen as a hero and a protagonist, to see him turn into this slimy, creepy, grimy, like cult leader who even walks like somebody I would smack with a 2x4. Like, to see them be able to utilize him and him embody that character so well, I loved how much I hated him in this movie. Yeah. And to be able to do that from somebody like Chris Hemsworth is a phenomenal, you know, objective to achieve, because I actually really like all the things that Chris Hemsworth does. And to see him in this role and to see how far he goes to be that much of a jerk, I just love that. And I think for me, that is as much of a standout performance. Maybe not as much as Cynthia Erivo, but I think in terms of like great performances, that's a highlight for me, easily.
I would say also, to echo what I said about Blindspotting, I wish I was hearing Bad Times at the El Royale mentioned more during awards season. Like, I think that there's quite a bit in here, from cinematography to the sound design, lighting design, all of that, several of the performances. I just think there's a lot that, for one reason or the other, is overlooked. And I would point out, we've mentioned this in other episodes in the past where we talk about how do award nominations work.
Yeah.
It does take an investment from the studio, and or, you know, the publicist for the actor or whatever it is, whatever the right mix is. You do have to put together money and packages to deliver to, you know, the Producers Guild, the Writers Guild, the Academy, whatever it is. In order for it to be considered, it has to qualify. And then from there, they take all the qualifying considerations and turn those into nominations, and then those are voted on, and people get statues and give speeches and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's possible that, you know, something like Blindspotting or Bad Times at the El Royale, maybe they didn't put together a nomination packet, you know, for consideration to begin with.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are some of that's not a an across the board rule. There are some awards givers, award entities, associations that don't require massive political investment behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And I just wish I was hearing both of those films more.
Very true. And just to kind of mention, I do remember seeing some colleagues from LA who have received, in terms of their entries for like the BAFTAs and whatnot,
yeah,
their press package from them. So I'm hoping that there's some mention of them once the other awards start filing through and they get recognized for all the great work they've done on that film. One of the other highlights for me this year actually occurred earlier into the year, around April. And I have to say, I wasn't expecting much from this film just because of the actor slash director of the film. In fact, I think he even wrote it. I'm not too sure. But we're looking at Lesson 108, A Quiet Place, directed by John Krasinski and also starring John Krasinski. This film was one of those types of movies where, yes, John Krasinski played Jim from The Office. Mm-hmm. We all know that. That's the extent of what I've known him to do. He did one smaller film with the issue overseas that... 13 Hours, yeah. Yes. But I didn't watch that. I wasn't a big fan of that. This movie, it was directed by him, and he starred in it, and you just knew that if there was ever a film to make or break a particular filmmaker in the industry, it would be a film like this. And seeing this movie, I was blown away entirely. I think this movie is so underappreciated because of what all it does and how it puts the story together. Its ability to not even use many words. Like, I think the full amount of words that this film uses could be counted on two hands through the entire span of it. And I loved it. It was so great. It was so wonderful. We titled the lesson actually ASMR Aplenty because of the fact of how quiet the theater needed to be in order for you to experience everything that was happening.
Super cool experience in the theater.
If you've ever been to the movies, you'll know how hard it is for everybody to be quiet at the same time. Every single time we went into a showing for this movie, everybody was quiet.
You could hear people whispering to each other across the room. You could hear them clear as a bell. I had no idea that the kind of empty room acoustic situation of a movie theater is as effective as it is, because sound is so big most of the time. And this movie, I was like, I am blown away by how effectively this movie theater can conduct like ambient noise within the theater space. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is crazy how quiet you get watching this movie if you're doing it right.
I remember someone was talking in the film and I was like turned around to see how close they were to me. They were super far away.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Who's chewing in my ear? It's the guy all the way in the front section of the room. And it's really awesome to even see like people recognize how great this film is. Stephen King himself actually tweeted that A Quiet Place, quote, is an extraordinary piece of work, terrific acting, but the main thing is the silence and how it makes the camera's eye open wide in a way few movies manage. To be able to hear that from one of the masters of horror, Stephen King, I feel like this movie was so much more than just a horror film. I feel like this movie just erred on the side of thriller to sci-fi piece to... I felt my heart beat so much so in this film that I'm pretty sure I could have heard it too while we were watching the movie. This is an excellent piece of cinema and one of the highlights from this past year. And I can't wait, honestly, to see what they're going to do because they've talked about creating a sequel.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been greenlit.
Yeah.
They just don't have a script yet.
And there you go. Well, I'm excited to see.
Or they didn't as of the last time I read anything about it.
We're going to have to look into that. But this is one of the things that I'm now looking forward to with future projects is seeing where John Krasinski is having a hand in. Now, this is a director I can trust. You know, as opposed to we've had the Michael Bays, we've had all these other people who have created films and have failed us or have done whatever. And it's sad that the only person that comes to mind when I think of directors that have failed us is Michael Bay. But either way,
he's not the only one.
Well deserved.
But to recognize that John Krasinski, even though I'm nobody, I'm just another podcaster like the rest of us, John Krasinski has earned my trust as a filmmaker, and I look forward to seeing the next project he has.
And it bears mentioning his wife, his actual wife, yes. Emily Blunt, who also plays his character's wife in this film. A-game. She totally brought 100%. Her A-game to this movie. All the performers did. Completely. But like she is the one who really sold the experience of the characters in the film. Yeah. Like I'm cringing now. Like my foot is like cramped.
Oh gosh.
Because of that.
Oh, that's right. Right.
The worst.
That's right. That scene. Oh my
like,
gosh.
Like, I just, it's so impressive. Her restraint and yet her, like, just presence in spite of all the restraint that had to be shown. Like, it was really, really A-plus work.
Yeah. Spence, do you have another positive?
Black Panther!
Of course!
The king is back and he is amazing. Black Panther was an amazing movie. That was one I was just waiting for to come out because ever since he showed up in Captain America: Civil War, I was waiting for the full length movie of just Black Panther and Wakanda and seeing what that was all about.
Which, by the way, if you're not too sure, Black Panther is lesson 100, so check that out.
I really should start saying these because they're right in front of me. But no, I just everything about Wakanda, I'm still just waiting to go back there in the Marvel Universe. It just so many things came together to make such an amazing movie. Just the soundtrack was great in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
The actors, they did a fantastic job, especially Michael B. Jordan and Killmonger. Mm-hmm. Like, apparently he had to, like, go into therapy to get rid of that guy because I was following him around. Oh, yeah, it was a serious thing. Like, Killmonger was just the best.
and he wasn't even Black Panther. Well, he kind of was for a little while, but...
And then, like, just the outfits in this movie... Everyone
looked, the costumes were on point.
Yeah. It was just... And then you had Angela Bassett in there as the Queen of Wakanda.
Oh, come on. Don't leave my girl hanging.
Yeah, no. She... Ooh. Like, just... This movie gets me excited. And so it's probably, like, you know, definitely, like, my top movie of the last year.
Well, I think it's safe to say Black Panther started this year off and kind of set the tone for what we were to be expecting in terms of films that speak on that social commentary aspect. Mm-hmm. We mentioned earlier Blindspotting was an incredible film, but Blindspotting came later in the year, whereas Black Panther, I believe, debuted in February. And we're looking at Black Panther is honestly the film that set the tone for what to expect come 2018 for theater, for film. And it's safe to say that Black Panther delivered on every promise that we were ever given. When we saw Black Panther in Civil War, when we saw the trailers, when we were all hoping to see everything that we were wanting to see with Wakanda, everything, everything that we wanted to see, everything and more we were given.
I think it's also there's definitely like a component to me that stood out in terms of like, this is what we go to the movies for.
Completely.
Like, and yes, do you go sometimes to validate your opinion about something, or, you know, for social commentary, or, you know, it's a good documentary or whatever? Absolutely, sure. Most people, most of the time, are going to the movie theater to escape for a couple hours. There's that escapist, like, show me something I've never seen before. Show me the world in a way I've never seen it before.
Yeah.
Show me something that someone that I can root for, and a cause that I can get behind. And I think that Black Panther had all of those things in spades. Okoye. I like.
Oh my God.
Don't even get me started. That oh my character needs to be in every Marvel Cinematic Universe film in the rest of time. For the rest of time.
Danai Gurira.
She was extraordinary.
Yeah.
But like Spencer, like you said, the set design, the character motivations, the costumes, the music. I mean, it's like, why can't the world be like this? You know, yeah. Definitely like that. And it's not like what I loved about it was it doesn't there's commentary without being direct commentary. It's not like, let's talk about the world the way it is right now. It's more of a, let's show you a vision of how the world could be if we all knew how to get along.
Yeah.
And do right and see potential in everyone everywhere. You know, obviously Wakanda is also separatist and keeps itself a secret and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, minor points to make about the nuances of the story. But in terms of like the real Wakanda and what's hidden behind the projection screen, if you will.
Yeah.
It's compelling. It's fun. I want to know more. I'm incredibly curious. I don't think we've even started mining the richness of that admittedly fictional society. But it really feels very similar to me to what I think it might have felt like for people who saw the first Star Wars film in the theater, where it's like, wow, you are showing me quality storytelling and a world that I want to go back to again and again and again and again. And for them to do that in like one locale, if you will, of the MCU that is not outer space,
mm-mm,
I think that is, again, masterstroke.
Yeah, completely. And not even across, like there's a couple times where the location is in either England or well, mostly England, or I'm sorry, Korea. No, where's it at? When they
What are you talking about?
In Black Panther.
In are you talking about
Oakland? They're in Oakland.
Are you talking about when they went to London in the museum?
And then when they fight with Killmonger.
Oh, the casino scene?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was in like one of the
casinos. Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Either way, like it doesn't spend.
How could I forget the wig?
The wig. Throwing the wig as a weapon. The fact that those are two minimal set locations and the majority of this film takes place in Wakanda, that's really something to be said, because of the fact that you don't have to take the film clear across all over the world for the film to be interesting, for the sets themselves, for the scenes to be interesting. This film held my interest from beginning to end, and quite oddly enough, it sets the bar so high for what we expected the rest of 2018 in terms of the harmony on that set, and, you know, with the cast, with the set design, with, you know, the costumes, with the music, everything that seemed to just mesh perfectly, like perfectly fitting puzzle pieces. This movie was astounding, and really, I just you can't say it enough. Every time a movie like this comes out, it resets the bar. And so far, Black Panther as a superhero film, first off, and secondly, as just great storytelling, this film set a really high bar. And you know, it's safe to say that it's still up there in terms of like one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Chad, you got another one for us?
Yeah, I am going to point out that the review of Black Panther, Lesson 100, had one of my favorite moments of any review we've ever done on the show. And yes, that was when Spencer got emotional. But like, to hear the authenticity that you shared in terms of like how it felt for you to sit in the theater and watch that movie and see that those characters.
Yeah.
Like, so powerful, so noble, so accomplished, and worth rooting for in every regard, no exceptions. It was a really special moment. And I don't say that just because you got emotional. Like, it was, we can talk a lot and like to hear the sound of our own voices, but to get to something that is like bedrock serious and real and very deeply meaningful for your life, that can be very rare to feel at all in the theater, and especially to express out loud. So hats off, because that was a really special moment for me just sitting at the table with you. And I use that as a segue to movies that made me cry, because there were a couple of them. Both of which I had like active rivers of tears running down my face. And it's going to be weird to rehear it. I mean, you're not going to be surprised when I say it, but, the first one was Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is Lesson 121. It was a documentary about Mr. Rogers, it was one of the few shows that we were allowed to watch when I was very young. So I saw many, many episodes of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But then like to see like all this behind the scenes stuff and the consistency of this man.
Yeah.
In front of the camera, behind the camera, like on his off days, whatever it was, just to see the heart that he had for kids. And to know that it's not like it wasn't, I kept wondering like going into it, I'm like, I worried, is this like an expose? Like, am I going to learn stuff about Mr. Rogers that I don't want to know? Like, I don't want that to tarnish part of my childhood, because I really enjoyed like when he took me to the chocolate factory or he introduced me to the police officers or whatever. Like, there were all kinds of things that he did on that show.
Yeah.
And it was inexpensively made, but it has I think a pretty timeless, nigh universal value to a lot of the authenticity and the way that he invited kids to express their feelings, work through their feelings, you know, not hide them or feel like they had to change them, or whatever. And just, there were numerous times in this documentary I was weeping soundlessly. I was silent crying.
Yeah.
Beside you guys in the theater, but like, it gripped me.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to tarnish what I remembered about Mr. Rogers, but I also didn't expect that it was going to impact me as much as it did.
Yeah, I think that was one of those instances where I thought like you did. I'm like, I don't want to see a documentary that's going to show me all the things like, oh, and behind the scenes, Mr. Rogers used to beat his dog. Like, I didn't want to hear about like the negative aspect, but hearing people talk about how positive it was and how, you know, how hopeful that the film made him feel, I had a better outlook on watching the film. And then after seeing it, I'm like, this documentary is incredible. Like, I felt like not only did I have a better understanding of Fred Rogers, the performer, but I had a much deeper understanding of Fred Rogers, the man, you know, whom learning his whole life story and recognizing like a lot of the parts of him that were still so human, even all the way up until towards the end of his life, recognizing all those parts and being able to see it and see that even in that time he was still trying to be positive and uplifting. It's a very powerful documentary. And I remember Spencer was with us too, and Spencer also had a hard time with it as well. We all had a hard time with that movie.
We all did. I think my favorite part from that movie though is when Mr. Rogers goes to Washington to fight money for public television, and he was against some senator who was just adamantly against it, and then he just spoke for a while and then completely changed this man's mind. I'm like, that's amazing. Like, that was the
coolest
thing.
It gives
thing.
You goosebumps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it was so good. It was a really good one.
Yeah, super good. The other one that made me cry, shortly thereafter, lesson 124, Christopher Robin.
Yep, yep.
I grew up watching Winnie the Pooh movies and stuff, and part of it was how adorable the character designs were, because they were really stinking adorable.
They were.
The whole, like, real texture mm-hmm. of, you know, felt stuffed animals and all that kind of stuff that they had going on. But there were just, I have always loved the simple logic of the character of Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
The other characters have their strong points too, but Winnie the Pooh, like the character, the way that he sees the world and the way that he articulates like soul deep truths in a very simple way. And like sometimes it'll get me. Like I will see quotes on things in, you know, like gift shops and stuff, and it's like, oh, Winnie the Pooh, and I'm like, gosh, that bear, so stinking smart and heartfelt. I'm getting all sentimental, but like there were legit a couple of times in that movie, I again had rivers of tears. Part of it was because it was reminding me of a dear relative of mine, very close to me, who had you know passed unexpectedly the year before. And I was very sentimental in thinking about her, my grandma. But some of it was just like the cinematography of some of these scenes is astoundingly gorgeous.
Yeah.
And the way that they let certain moments just you sit there and it sinks in and they don't jump into the next scene right away. I really enjoyed the pace of the storytelling and how it really lets certain lines or certain musical cues or certain moments just really open up.
Yeah. I'm sitting here and I'm trying to think, I'm like, what would be a great quote to just kind of throw in there? And I'm reading through all the quotes from the movie and I just find myself smiling all over again. Like just the ridiculousness of how great and the logic of Pooh is. Like from the trailer where he says, your ladder is broken. Christopher Robin's like, that was a shelf. He's like, well, that explains why I was no good for climbing. Like, that's just gold. And I just, that movie will always, always have you in the feels when you watch it because of not just how much it reaches to the nostalgic aspect of individuals, but also how well it can connect with young people and how well it can connect with audiences of all ages. And that's the sign of great storytelling. That's the sign of a great property that really was done and executed well, you know, plain and simple. So, yeah, that was an awesome film. To kind of round out and kind of give some of the last thoughts, another awesome film that I thought really kind of stood out, and I know it's a kind of a recent film that we talked about. We've talked about a couple of recent films, but in all honesty, Creed 2 was a really great film. Mm-hmm. We talk about storytelling. This film had we mentioned Mortal Engines, and I did this in the other episode as well, lesson 140. We talked about Mortal Engines and how discombobulated that film was. This movie, Creed 2, was such a fine performance of juggling acts, multiple juggling acts, creating this wonderful, you know, conversion of stories to create this just powerful film that I had to see. I actually paid again to go see it.
Oh, I did too.
I had to because this movie is just so phenomenal how it executes this story and how it, first off, it creates this story. It reawakens certain parts of the lore that people have held on to and collides them with the modern story that is happening right now, bringing these different elements to the table. On top of all that, other elements that are happening at the same time, other people's stories, and then all of a sudden, at the tail end, right at the climax of the film, having all of them just converge onto one stage and become this harmonious sound of, you know, light and magic. Like, it's a phenomenal film, and I really, really enjoyed the heck out of that movie. Like, plain and simple. Why did you see it again, Spence?
My friend was like, oh, man, I never saw Creed 2. I was like, let's go see it today. And we did.
Don't waste a second.
Yeah, no. I went back and I just watched again. Because, you know, sometimes it's good to see a movie twice just to really sink into it. And this was just such a perfect setup for a movie of, like, having him face off against Ivan Drago's son.
Yeah.
Like, that's all sorts of conflict that I want to be there for because that's just insane. And
yeah.
The movie, like, again, like, I know I probably said this in the episode, like, I have no idea how they're going to even try to attempt to top this movie.
Yeah.
Because it's that good.
Yeah, I
agree. Well, and here's the thing. In all honesty, it should not have worked.
No,
like
not at all.
To have started where they started and ended where they ended, and for all the pieces in between to have worked and to feel like a complete story with a satisfying ending, that should not have worked.
Yeah.
And somehow it did. That's magic.
Yeah. And oddly enough, when it came to this particular film with Creed 2, it's not really getting a lot of attention in terms of awards. Like, there's not many nominees that are being talked about. There's not much Oscar buzz about this film, although it was a great film. It was a great piece of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And it's this is one of those elements where we have to look at where's the line drawn between focusing on just, like, puff pieces, films that are just made to be pretty to look at, i.e. movies like Skyscraper or The Meg.
Oh, gosh.
All those other movies that are just made for visual stimulation. As opposed to, like, films like Creed 2, which it has action in it. It's made to be like a visual film. You're seeing action. You're seeing boxing. But the story element is so much stronger than any choreography this film could have that I'm like, this needs to get recognized without a doubt. Michael B. Jordan has been one of the standout performers for 2018 mm-hmm. between Killmonger and Creed, Adonis Creed in this film. It's safe to say I think he should really get some attention, if not for Killmonger, at least for Creed 2. So, and before we kind of wrap this all up, Spence, do you have one more movie to give us before we kind of wrap this whole thing up? And I kind of gift wrapped this last film for you because I was hoping you're going to talk about it. I'll give you a hint. It's lesson 142.
That's what I'm hoping too.
What I was going to do.
I was saying.
I already had my quote lined up of, all right, let's do this one last time. My name is Peter Parker, and I was bitten by a radioactive spider. I was all ready to go.
He was ripped and ready to go. I'm like, I'm throwing it up to you, Spence. You got to spike it.
Yeah, I was already playing Sunflowers in my head. I was ready for it.
Oh, my gosh. Spider-Man. I still need that song.
Into the Spider-Verse.
Yes.
That just came out last month, and I love
that. What lesson was
that,
Spence?
That was 142.
There we go.
I got one. After you gave it to me. Yeah, that movie. He is my Spider-Man. I loved that movie so much. It was just great to see not the normal Peter Parker that we see in all the films. It was nice to see, like, Peter B. Parker and then just Miles Morales himself finally get to, like, really know him and all the crazy other spider people who show up in this movie. The art style of this movie was phenomenal.
Yeah.
I have never seen anything like it, and I hope to see it again, hopefully in another Spider-Man movie too, because that'd be great.
Well, and this film is definitely a contender in terms of the animation category.
It's already a winner.
It is.
Yeah, it already won for Best Motion Picture in the Animated category for the Golden Globes.
It really should.
Yeah, no doubt. The fact that, and like I said, if you go back to the lesson, we talk at length in terms of the quality of animation this film holds, but just to give you a small snippet of that, the film itself had so many animators as a part of this project that, like we said in the episode, it's a wonder and a surprise as to why the heck did Sony Animation come out with the Emoji Movie last year. So, just saying. But this film is a complete turnaround from that garbage heap, you know, the Emoji Movie, because this movie has story, this movie has a unique animation style, this movie has heart, and it holds true to the fan base that many people have been hoping to see, which is a great modern-day Spider-Man interpretation of Miles Morales. Like, people have been wanting to see that for a long time now, with Donald Glover as a part of the project at one point, and there's all this you know, talk all back then, but the fact that now we have it and now it's here and it delivered, that says a lot. So I think this was one of the bright points for 2018. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and also if you haven't had a chance to check it out yet, you should go to the Facebook page for Into the Spider-Verse.
Uh-huh.
They posted artwork of Miles Morales in his new Spider-Man costume, holding the Golden Globe.
That is super cool.
So yeah, pretty. I mean, their marketing for this film has certainly been on point, start to beyond finish.
Yeah.
And I can't personally wait until they do more spinoffs and sequels and all the above.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that this franchise is not going anywhere anytime soon, and I am excited to see the follow-up to this particular film, as well as a lot of the films that we talked about in positivity. And there was so many other films that we wanted to highlight this year, but these were just some of the few that we could talk about within the time frame of a show that you would actually be willing to sit through and listen in one sitting. So we're glad that you got a chance to sit with us, and we are still looking forward to the things in 2019, looking forward to a lot of great films. There's a lot of awesome movies that are going to be coming out from the House of Mouse. You got a lot of great films on the horror aspect. There's a lot of things that are on the horizon, and you'll be hearing us talk about them as the year continues. So as we wrap this up, we're going to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases coming down. You got The Upside, starring Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston, Replicas, and Perfect Strangers. So head on out to your local theaters, check out one of these films or one of the films that we've talked about that was released recently, and go support your local theater, man.
Woohoo!
So... with all that said, we hope that you had a great New Year's, and we can't wait to start getting into some of these new movies in 2019. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.